Welcome to Daniel Britt and Friends, an hour of good music and fun conversations featuring gospel music's brightest new artists, as well as legendary tributes and memories from its past. Now, here is Daniel Britt.
Here we are, set for another hour, and I love the classics. I love the old stuff, and as our friend Bill Gaither often says, we don't revisit old music just because it's old, just because it's a good memory, but because the songs that were performed and the old songs that we still remember today are around because they're good, and they live, and they say something that's eternal. And obviously, when you talk about Gaither, and he's been on this show many times, and in fact we co-hosted a nice documentary of old Statesman music with the Statesman Quartet. We're going to look at the Statesman again today, but we're going to get even more specific and look at the bass singer. I mean, the bass singer in gospel music is one of the most loved characters and personalities in the quartet, because that voice, that bass line, and all the bass tricks they pull out of their bag, man, that's what brings the fans back over and over. And there's been a lot of great ones in our industry. We've produced a lot of outstanding singers who hit those low notes, not the least of which, Big Chief Wetherington. Big Chief passed away in 1973. Never had the opportunity of knowing him or talking to him or anything. But we have on our guest line his daughter, Diana Wetherington Helton. Diana, it's good to have you here.
Well, thank you, Daniel. It's very good to be here.
Now, I've heard so much about your dad. Honestly, the Statesmen, I mean, especially in their glory days, way before my time. But, you know, as kind of maybe a historian of this music, I love going back and studying what they did. They perfected this art form. They paved the way. I mean, a lot of groups were there in those days, but the Statesmen were at the top, I think. But they were definitely on top of their game. Would you agree with that, right?
Oh, yeah, I would agree with that. And when you consider the different shows they did and the different types of appearances, yeah, I'd say they probably were considered one of the top groups.
Well, I've got, you know, your dad was born in 22, James Stephen Wetherington. Everybody called him Big Chief, it seems. If you don't mind, I mean, when did you come into the picture?
I came into the picture in 1954.
54.
Mom and Dad had been married for about 12 years. And, of course, that was after the World War II years. And they were a little bit late in starting their family. And I think they had actually been trying for some time when I came along, so I'm it though.
Yeah, so you're an only child?
I'm an only child. Now my parents did raise my mother's niece, Deborah Jean, and but she was nearly 12 years old by the time I came along. So,
wow.
I still am more of an only child.
Sure.
When you have that kind of an age spread.
Do you think? I assume that you have talked to current gospel artists. You're probably friends with a lot of them. Do you think that your story is similar to most kids today who have parents who sing and travel in gospel music?
I'd say so. Most of us that grew up backstage, and you've probably talked to a good many of them over the years yourself.
Yeah.
We had pretty normal childhoods. My mother preferred to stay home and kept me pretty much at home, and I went through public school. A lot of the kids that I knew, of course, backstage, they were homeschooled, but a few of them, went through just regular schools like I did. But I'd say it's probably a normal life. I was just thinking about this yesterday. Since the Statesman traveled about 280 days out of the year, I was just thinking, you know, what... how normal it seemed for me. I mean, I didn't know anything different.
Right.
So it was always great when Dad was home. And when he was home, we spent a lot of time together.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
We played hard, and we played golf together, and, ever since I was old enough to remember. So, my time with my dad was very special, and I didn't know what it was like to have a 9-to-5 dad.
Yeah, well, yeah, really, really. And there's a lot of perks that come with being the daughter of someone like Big Chief, I imagine. Yeah, you get to meet interesting people, and from time to time, I'm sure you got to go to some interesting places.
Yeah, I traveled some during the summer. Uh-huh. Of course, when I was younger, mother would go with us. And then when I was about, 10 or so, I would take off during the summers with Dad.
Oh, that's cool.
And I'd spend weeks on the road, and that was interesting and a lot of fun. And but you got to remember, it's also very boring.
Yeah, especially
you know,
for
a kid. You have a lot of time to yourself, a lot of tedium time, time on the bus. There was a lot of card playing, reading books. I usually took my sketch pad, I drew. And you just kind of would wait for the moments, you know, and it was a great life. I mean, we had a lot of fun.
Big Chief began his career in the late 40s. Sunny South Quartet, I guess, is where he really got started, and then went with Melody Masters in about 49 or so. Or 49, I guess, is when he joined the Statesmen. So in the 40s, Sunny South and Melody Masters. And then, so within 9 years, maybe say on-the-job training for those 9 years, and then bam, the Statesmen hit the scene.
Right.
Now, from what you know from history, I mean, would you say that your dad, they always talk about kind of a period where they have to gel, where they have to really get to know each other, and the voices and the harmonies just, eventually will start to work. Some groups that takes a period, some groups it's very instantaneous. Do you know how that it all worked out with your dad when he joined the Statesmen from day one?
In talking to people and listening to people and reading what a lot of people have had to say over the years, it seems like it was a pretty good gel right at the very beginning. I know when Jake had already joined Hovey, and then they brought Dad in to replace Asel Sword. So it was like they needed a strong voice. They needed, you know, someone who was very strong and who had a wide range. And Dad just fit that bill. So he pretty much stepped right in there. And he had a range that was pretty incredible for a bass singer. People often ask me, you know, well, how low could he sing? Well, he could sing a lot lower than he recorded, but he didn't want to. He didn't feel like they could do justice to the music if he sang too awfully low. So, but I've heard him hit some notes that were unbelievable.
Wow! Goodness.
They used to call it singing the left leg of the piano.
Yeah, right. Of course, J.D. Sumner has passed on as well, and J.D. is known as one of the great bass singers. Did you know J.D.? Did your dad have a good relationship with him?
Yeah, oh, sure. Knew J.D. very well. In fact, J.D. grew up in Lakeland, Florida, which is where my mom and dad both were when they were married. And my mother actually knew his family quite well. They were kind of neighbors, if not his immediate family. He had family and cousins all over Lakeland. And then when Dad was 16, 17, I forget which now, and he left the farm in Tai-Tai and he went to go with his mother, who was living in Lakeland at the time, and he started singing at local churches around the area. That's when he first met J.D., because J.D. was also doing the same thing, you know, singing with the local groups, singing in churches. You know, they would hop around from church to church. In fact, I often asked Mother, I said, the way you make it sound, it sounds like there were dozens of churches in Lakeland, and all the singers just kind of hop from church to church. And she said, well, that's pretty much the way it was. and that's how they met, Mom and Dad.
Wow.
And Mom was actually playing the piano at the Methodist church. I believe it was First Methodist in Lakeland. And she met him one time when he visited there. And then I think they also, again, later met at a small interdenominational church that was there. And that's kind of when that spark of a relationship started. So, and yeah, and Dad and Mom and JD and, gee, there was a bunch of them in that central Florida area. And JD's, you know, his family was where they were always good friends. It just hurts me to think they're all gone now.
Oh, I know. Well, when you talk about these friends, I know he had plenty. George Yontz, another great bass singer, I've heard him tell the story. Mm-hmm. And I think it was on the very, very first Gaither homecoming that ever was, that accidental taping. George told a story about Big Chief having like an abscessed tooth, and a sweet lady came and prayed for him, and George even kind of impersonated Big Chief in telling that story.
Mm-hmm. You know, the Chief was known for readings. Probably wasn't the first bass singer that you know, because people love to hear people talk with low voices, and you know, and he could get your attention on getting down that low tone of his voice.
When I finished my prayer and opened my eyes, there stood Old Blue. Was I ever surprised? He began to whine and lick my chin as if to say, boy, where in the world have you been? Then I heard my grandpa's whistle shrill. The most beautiful sound, I can hear it still. He'd whistle many times to call me in from play, but that one long whistle, I can hear it today. I closed my eyes and said, thank you, Lord. I knowed I'd get found if you would just say the word.
Was he a soft-spoken person?
I did not know Chief that well, but when I talked to him, he was a very likable human being. I mean, he would engage the room. When he came into the room, he owned the room. First of all, he was very handsome. Yeah. In fact, that whole bunch was a handsome bunch of guys. And, and you know, people just liked him because, I mean, when they went to New York, they just went crazy over him.
I remember George Yance on the first Homecoming video told the story, of course, telling it. The only way he could tell it, he said, was to try to imitate Big Chief with the abscessed tooth.
Yeah.
And the lady who prayed for him.
Yeah. I mean, it's very tender. You know, these guys, in fact, Hovey would never let Chief be around George during a day of a concert because he knew that they'd start telling stories and Chief would be laughing so hard that he would lose about four or five notes on the lower part of his range, because when you laugh that hard on your throat, it just, you know, it does some damage to your voice. And he and George would get together and just tell stories after story after story.
The station had just did a concert somewhere. And it was raining when they left that concert, but it kept getting colder and colder, and going through this little town. Chief was driving, and finally started sleeting, but he didn't know it sleeting at the time. When he got to the stoplight, or corner, he put on his brakes to stop. Well, the car just turned, started all kinds of, got out of control, and Chief was fighting that wheel. Well, there's a little kid at an all-night service station, and he saw the car coming, and sliding. Finally, slid into the gas station, bumped up against the gas tanks, and come back about a foot, and Chief stepped out, all in suit and tie, and said, fill her up, kid.
Another friend of Big Chief, and I've recently kind of heard more about this as Bill Gaither told it to me, about his ties, his friendship with Elvis Presley. That's pretty cool.
That was pretty cool. Of course, being a child of the 60s and 70s, I wasn't too impressed at the time. You got to understand, you know.
Right.
I mean, that was a time when the rock and roll bands were coming up and the Beatles and all this other stuff. So, I mean, right. Elvis had kind of gone into his hibernation and had just started doing concerts again.
Hmm.
And we went to a concert, one of the first concerts he did here in Atlanta. And we all sat together, and of course Elvis recognized everybody from the stage. And I looked over at Dad, and I went, "You really do know Elvis?" You know, I'd heard these stories over the year, and Elvis would call the house.
Really?
I mean, I'd answer the phone, and he'd say, "Hey, is the Chief there?" You know, and I'd go, "Yeah, sure." You know, just one more person calling the house.
Wow.
And I've talked to him on a couple of occasions. In fact, in 1970, I was Miss Dove, and I handed out the Dove Awards that year. And I think it was still in Memphis. And Elvis and Priscilla showed up backstage, and they sat backstage most of the evening and just enjoyed the concert, just sat right there on the edge of the stage. And I sat there probably between them probably most of the concert, and that was a really memorable experience.
Yeah.
They were two very, very nice people.
Well, the thing that comes up with Elvis and your dad is, you know, that Elvis wanted to learn some different moves from mm-hmm. your dad. Now, gospel people have to be careful. You know, they don't like to call it dancing, but you know, the Statesmen would get into it with those rhythms. I mean, are you kidding? They almost invented all these different kind of rhythms, it seems like. Mm-hmm. But so, what would you say in home life? Maybe your mom and dad, did you ever see him ballroom dance? Was your dad, did he have rhythm?
Dad had a lot of rhythm. Neither one of them ever danced. It's interesting. I never saw them dance together. If they did, I was not aware of it. Dad had just a way of moving, and it was incredible. I know when he would buy watches, he would probably buy six of them at a time, because with the way he moved, watches would stop on him.
Wow.
We don't know why. There was something having to do with the magnetic field in his body plus his movement.
Right.
And he killed watches regularly.
Goodness gracious.
So there was something about just the way he moved, and Elvis noticed that. And he would get Dad in, backstage or whatever, and they'd stand, you know, like in front of the mirrors, and he'd go, now show me that move you make, you know, with your hands or whatever. And there are a few moves, if you look back on some of Elvis's old clips, that are virtually identical.
Wow.
And I asked Dad about this once. I said, so how do you feel about that? He said, he takes it and he makes it his, and that's fine. He said, he adds to it. He said, maybe he adds to it a little too much, but he said, you got to look at the genres. The genres were totally different.
Sure.
So Elvis could apply things his way, and Dad could apply things his way. So I don't think you can really say that either one of them really owned the traits.
Right, exactly.
Because they used them according to how they felt. And they both felt a lot of rhythm. They both had to move while they were on stage, and I think that was a good part of it. So, when you're on stage and you feel like if you're stuck behind a microphone and you can't walk around like they do now with the cordless mics, mm-hmm. and back then, you know, they only had two, maybe three mics on stage with a group.
Right.
So what you would do is you would have to use your upper body movement and your arms and your hands.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So, Elvis just kind of fell in love with it. He just was in love with gospel music in general. And he said, in another life, that's what I would have done, was to have been a gospel singer. Mm. And, you know, he attributed his start to singing it, you know, a lot of the early gospel concerts, and he would go to the Stockyards in Tupelo, and they'd call him on stage, and he would get up and perform. Dad said one of his earliest memories of Elvis was they called him up on stage at intermission to sing, and he said the kid had a voice. He had a talent.
Wow.
He said we knew then that he would definitely go far. And he was a very, very nice person. He was very laid back, still the country boy. I didn't, even sitting with he and Priscilla backstage, I did not see the big star. You know, he was right. Very down to earth.
Oh, yeah, I feel that something. I don't feel that burning inside. Oh, yeah. Have you had something? Oh, a burning like fire. Oh, yeah. Have you had something? Oh, I can't explain. Oh, yeah. You tell in a hurry. You tell everybody. I got something.
Diana Wetherington Hilton is in our guest line, the daughter of Jim Wetherington, Big Chief Wetherington. And by the way, you're in Atlanta, Georgia now, and mm-hmm. Statesmen, of course, known as an Atlanta group. They were based in Atlanta. So did you live there? Were you born there? You lived there all your life?
I was born here, lived here all my life. We're actually a little further north of Atlanta now, and we kind of got out of the traffic zone.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the native Atlantans, they just kind of move out, you know, ahead of traffic.
That's right.
We, for some reason, I've never quite figured out why Hovey chose to live in Atlanta rather than Nashville. And I think they felt like, you know, Atlanta was kind of the next great hub Mm-hmm. And at the time, you know, they, I guess in the 40s and 50s and 60s, they were, you know, putting in the big airports, and they just kind of felt like being in Atlanta was the place to be. And yeah. Hovey was a good businessman, so I guess he called it.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Well, speaking of Hovey Lister and, of course, Jake Hess, mm-hmm. and then was Rosie there, who were some of the tenor singers? Changed a little bit, I guess, didn't they? Was it Doy?
Right. Uh-huh. Doy was baritone.
Oh, Doy was baritone. Okay.
Baritone. And then, of course, there was, you know, we had Rosie, and I remember Gary McSpadden was with the group. Ed Hill.
So Big Chief was there until what year? I mean, was he there until his death?
Oh, yeah.
So 73. So 20. Yeah. So from 49 until 73, that's a good long run to be with a group and a lot of, mm-hmm. I mean, not a lot of changes, but, you know, there were member changes. Were some of these guys, especially like maybe the mainstays like Jake and Hovey, were these guys kind of like uncles to you? I mean, especially you were an only child.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They're still, you know, to this day. I mean, they were Uncle Jake and Uncle Hovey. And, you know, you always had your uncles, and you always knew you could go to them. And particularly if you were a backstage brat.
Yeah.
You know, you had your uncles. I mean, I had Uncle JD, and I had, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So they were all honorary, glorified uncles. And I loved them all. They were fine people.
And the term Big Chief, now, I understand that Hovey Lister and Leroy Abernathy kind of came together and said he needed a nickname.
Mm-hmm.
And it was honoring his Indian heritage. You want to talk about Big Chief, the name Big Chief?
Well, that was funny. Actually, Leroy kind of did that as an aside to Hovey. He said, Hovey, he said, you know, with a name like James Wetherington, he said, that's going to be a mouthful on stage. Why don't you just call him something simple like Big Chief? You know, look at that dark coloring, you know.
Right.
And so Hovey just kind of started saying, this is James, Big Chief, James Wetherington. And all of a sudden people started calling him Big Chief.
Yeah.
And I asked Dad one time, I said, so, you know, where did this come from? He said, oh, he said, that was just kind of out of the blue. I said, well, how'd you feel about it? And he went, well, I was okay with it. He said, you know, that's what Hovey felt like he needed to do. That was okay. And because of his Indian heritage, he and his brother both got the real dark skin and the black hair. And
mm-hmm.
he looked very Native American. Now, since his death, I have also run some genealogy and found out there are 5 different tribes in his genealogy.
Wow.
So he wasn't just, Cherokee was the latest.
Right.
But it went all the way back to the first Wetheringtons on the continent. So.
Wow. Wow.
It definitely is a Native American there. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, so that's that can be a fun name. That's a cool nickname. And was he a pretty tall guy?
Yeah, he was 6'1".
Yeah.
He wore his clothes very well. I often said he could put on a paper bag and look good.
Aww.
He just had a wonderful frame to hang clothing on. In fact, a lot of times they would put a suit, when they were trying suits, they would put a suit on him first to see how it would hang.
Right.
And then they would try to adapt, you know, to see how it would hang on the other guys and how it would look. He would make a trip, you know, to a clothier somewhere. And in the later years, they would go to Academy Awards clothing out in Los Angeles for their stage suits.
Mm-hmm.
And he would make that trip. And then, you know, and then all the guys would bring them together and decide which ones they were going to use. So he could wear just about anything.
Oh, no.
I want to know that Jesus loves me.
Jesus will welcome me there. I do not want to be denied. Oh, let me live in that city fair. That's enough.
That's enough for me.
Even though I do not know the day my Savior will call, I must be dead. It's hiding up. If from earth I know they will call me. Oh, Lord, that's enough.
That's enough for me.
Yeah. I want to know.
I want to know.
that my Jesus will welcome me there.
I do not want to be denied.
Let me live.
Let me live in the
city fair.
Anybody ever lived that had more friends than he did.
Yeah.
In fact, I often said, if a man had an enemy, I never knew of it.
Wow. Wow.
He just was very personal. He loved people. He often said, you know, there's as many, he said, there's as many different religions as there are people. So you've got to look at the heart.
Yeah, it's true.
And he said, you look at the heart of a person, that's when you see the true person. And to this day, I mean, I'm a people person. I would rather sit and watch people or talk to people than anything else. So that's kind of a hobby. I mean, it's a great way to pass the time.
Absolutely. Well, and your mother, by the way, is still living.
She is.
And she's 95, is that right?
She'll be 95 August 31st. So she's knocking on the door.
Yeah.
She's in really good health. She's lost most of her vision to macular degeneration, but other than that, she's still kicking.
Yeah.
And sharp as a tack, so.
I'm always interested with quartet, especially men, quartet men, and then their families, because it's been said so much on this show, usually by the men and the husbands, that it's as much a calling for their wives and their family as it is, you know, what they do going out on the road. So how did your mom play that role you know, not only as mother and wife, but in a great sense, a lot of times maybe the full-time caretaker while your dad was on the road?
Right, right. My mother is an amazing woman. She always has been. If anybody who's ever met Elizabeth, or Liz, as they called her, they will tell you she was a very quiet, very subdued, very shy person. But I always thought of her as a very dynamic personality, because she was the person behind Dad. She always encouraged him. And from the way I understand it, when he was trying to decide what he was going to do, because when he started singing, he was working with the railroad in Florida. So in singing weekends and, you know, traveling short distances in the evening. And she told him, she said, you're not happy here. She said, you want to be singing. He said, yeah, I want to be singing. She said, well, why don't you go to some of these groups and see what, you know, if they can offer you something. Well, you know, should I really do? Yes, you should do that. You have the talent. So, and that's the way Dad always told it.
Wow.
And she was kind of the force behind that. And I asked her one time, I said, had you known he was going to be gone so much and travel as much and you would be by yourself so much, would you have done it any other way? And she said, oh, absolutely not. She said, because that's what made him happy. That was what made him him. So I always admired that. I'm not sure I could do that, you know.
Yeah, wow.
But yeah. Mother and I... we found things to do. I mean, when Dad was gone, we took classes together. We joined things together. You know, we had a lot of things. Consequently, we had no mother-daughter battle issues, because I would say we were also we're also good friends. And it's been pleasant, you know, to be with a parent that you can say that about. So. Especially after all these many years.
Absolutely. And I imagine you've stayed close with your mom through these years, especially since the passing of your dad, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, his death really hit us very, very hard. In fact, we kind of dropped out of sight as far as gospel music is concerned. We kind of dropped out of sight for about 8 years. It was just too painful.
Yeah.
It was really hard. I mean, we had friends who would still contact us, but I mean, to try to go to a concert or sing was just horrible. Just too many memories there.
Right.
But she's still a very strong person. I think that's probably one of the reasons why she's lived to 95. She just never gives up.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Yeah, she keeps pushing. She stays busy.
Yeah.
Because that's what she's always done. And I think the hard part to her right now is with losing her eyesight is not being able to do the thing she's always loved.
Right, right.
So she still manages to garden a little bit, and I tease her about that. She was complaining about the mosquitoes just this morning. Oh, we got to get rid of these mosquitoes in the backyard. I said, Mother, it's summer. You just got to live with them.
Did you tell her you were going to do this radio thing?
I did.
And I know what you told me, that she doesn't care to talk in public.
She said better you than me.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We'll have to slip you some questions on a piece of paper one day and get some answers from her.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know,
or she'll talk to you one-on-one. She just, she's mic shy. That's the best thing I can tell you. She's just mic shy. So she's, she pushed Dad so much, and I say that lovingly. She didn't push him, you know, out there. She did it because she knows what he wanted to do. But I think she just felt like her place was in the background, and that's not any different than a lot of these other wives.
Oh yeah, outside of the music, just in home life or at social events. A lot of times you find out that the onstage person comes home and becomes very reserved and very, not necessarily unlike his onstage personality or her onstage personality, but oftentimes you find that to be true, that the very outgoing public person is really kind of quiet and reserved off the stage.
I call it tanking up.
Yeah, yeah.
They have to come home and just kind of restore their vigor, you know, their persona.
Right, right. So do you think the roles of your mom and dad when home time, when you were at social events with friends, did it kind of reverse? Did your mom step out and was she the social butterfly and he became more reserved, or did they kind of maintain the same role?
Well, in my family, there was not a whole lot of social activities when Dad was home, because, you know, Mom knew that Dad had to have time to himself and time with his family. And so she, you know, they were both a little bit, what's the word I'm trying to use? They were a little bit careful about how much they socialized. In fact, I don't know about about the other groups, but in the Statesman, we rarely socialized with each other's families. We all had individual families, and we respected each other's families and privacy. Now, that's not to say we didn't get together sometimes, but it was just kind of a rare event. I saw more of the families when I was out on the road traveling with Dad.
Yeah.
So, yeah, as far as, you know, Mother was in her element at home.
Yeah.
And that was where she really could shine. I mean, my mother was a wonderful cook, and she was a very gracious hostess. And, you know, Daddy would just basically sit down and smile and love her. I mean, you could see how proud he was of her.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was great with people all the time.
Right.
But, you know, when he was home, he was doing things like writing music, and he was, you know, basically getting his head together, and he would pursue his other interests. He was a biblical scholar. I mean, he was a self-taught theologian, if you will. And he actually would find people that he could sit and talk to at length. You know, he would find a pastor and pick his brain, or someone who taught theology and pick his brain.
Wow.
And there was very little about the Bible that, you know, you couldn't ask Dad a question on, and he can give you an answer. And he was very well read. Daddy read a lot.
Wow, that's good to hear.
He was a constant reader. In fact, we used to laugh when they would come home a lot of times when they had the old bus.
Mm-hmm.
You remember the old, before the Silver Eagles?
Right, right.
A lot of times they would bring it out to our house, and he and Mom would go through and clean it about four times a year. They would do a really deep cleaning of this thing. And Mother used to just die laughing, because he would have books I mean, on every subject you cannot imagine. He would have them like a foot high in this compartment under his bunk, where he would finish one and he'd just toss it in.
Yeah.
And she'd go, you know, you've got to do something with these books. And he would just give these things away by the wheelbarrow load. And I remember thinking the other day when we sold, after he died and we sold the house, I went through the attic and pulled out all these books. And now I wish I had a few of them. He had some first edition Zane Greys and things like that. He loved cowboy novels, too.
Uh-huh.
I wish I had them now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You should hold on to those. Well, you know, I'm glad you said that about Big Chief, because oftentimes you hear about gospel music singers and they hone their skill musically and their talent. And sometimes you wonder, you know, well, are there other interests? Well, are there other, are you growing or learning in other areas too? And so it sounded like he was a very well-rounded guy.
Oh, another thing that Dad did, and this is probably a little-known fact, was he wrote and recorded commercials.
Oh, really?
Yes, he did. He did radio and TV spots.
Uh-huh.
You know, because of his voice, and you know Steve Brown,
right? Yeah,
a very similar type thing because Dad had the basso voice,
right?
They liked to use that just because it came over the radio very well.
Yeah,
and he would accept jobs from different companies to do commercials for them, and he would write them. And sometimes Dad and I would sit down together, and he would say, "Well, how does this sound? And how does this sound?" Or he'd write something for two people, and he'd say, "Well, here, you read this part." And so we made several commercials together. And then he's probably best known for commercial. There was the Southern Bread Company did a commercial back in the, and I'm going to say the late 50s or early 60s, but I'm going to guess it was late 50s. And the little blurb in the commercial was I would even go north for Southern bread. And he did it in this very deep Southern Kentucky Colonel kind of a voice.
Right.
And I want you to know, I heard that commercial for the next 20 years.
Wow.
Until that company was bought out by one of the bigger bakery companies.
Wow.
And people would call, you know, they would ask him, they'd go, "Is that you doing that commercial?" And he'd go, yeah, that was me doing that commercial. So people would recognize the voice.
Show we mentioned Bill Gaither and his love for the Statesman. I'm sure you've talked to Bill probably numerous times about your dad.
Oh yeah.
And I don't know, he's probably said this to you, and maybe other people too have said this, but he brought this up in the interview we had about the Statesman. Listen.
Interesting thing they had going for them, and it was shown in the song Let Out of Bondage, was they had a bass singer that probably was the first rapper in the business, in the gospel music business. He was a rapper. God shall wear slaves and eat a lamb, but God took Moses by the hand. He said, Moses, tell old Pharaoh to set him free.
Yeah.
I mean, he would just talk. He was just talking the words. You know, he wasn't singing. Yeah. The big chief.
Rap artist. Has you ever heard that with your dad?
Yes, and I don't know if Bill said it first or if I did.
Oh, okay, yeah.
He probably did.
Yeah.
That's funny because some of the recitations that he did were funny, but like do you remember the old play, The Music Man?
Yeah.
All right, what was the song in there that the guy did about pool, you know, it's a...
Right.
Starts with P, whatever it is, in Central Pool, whatever it is. Trouble, that's what it was called.
Trouble, yes, that's right.
Starts with a T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool.
Right.
He decided on a whim one day it would be fun to memorize that entire song. And he would go around the house with his piece of paper memorizing this. I do not know why, except that he felt like it was a good exercise.
Yeah.
You know, singers do music exercises and exercises where they feel like they can get their words out better and plainer.
Yeah, right.
So that when you sing it, it's a lot more understandable.
Yeah.
And above all, when he wrote a song, when he sang a song, he wanted people to hear that message. He never wanted any confusion as to what he was saying. So he decided to learn this crazy song. Then after that, you know, some of the songs that he started writing in the recitations that he did started popping up. I'm going, and they got faster, and they got faster.
Right.
And we probably still have a few things that he's written around here that never got recorded. He wrote gobs of poetry.
Uh-huh.
And I have boxes full of this stuff. And to hear him say it and to recite it really, really fast, you know, the faster he could do it and get the words out, you know, just spit them out
so that people
could understand them, the happier he was. So I fully agree with Bill Gaither. He'd have had fun with rap. Not that he would have agreed with it, but he'd have had fun with it.
Yeah. Well, the song Let Out of Bondage, you know, I think it's a song that really highlights this.
And he was known, you know, for his ability to do that. He was the first guy to do stuff like that.
God promised to lead his children out of bondage. He said he'd free them from Pharaoh's evil hand. He said he'd guide them, take them on the journey, and lead them to the promised land.
God shall have our slave in Egypt land, so God took Moses by the hand, said Moses, hello, Pharaoh, set him free. But Moses wanted a way to get out, cause in his mind he began to doubt, said, Lord, oh, Pharaoh, ain't gonna listen to me. Now the Lord said, son, throw down that rod, oh, Moses did, then he cried to God, for he turned to a snake, as wicked and evil as sin. Then he cried again with an awful wail, for the Lord said, see, he's in by the tail, oh, Moses did, then it turned to a rod again.
God promised to lead his children out of bondage. He said he'd free them from Pharaoh's evil hand. He said he'd guide them, take them on the journey, and lead them to the promised land.
The Lord said, Moses, I've got power, and I'll be with you every hour. Said, go tell Pharaoh to set my children free. Well, Moses did, the Lord helped out. He sent the plague to the land of Mount Lo. Pharaoh told him to go and let him be. So they started out with a cloud by day and a fire by night. But to lead the way, Lo, Pharaoh suddenly decided to change his mind. So he gathered together his soldier band, got all the chariots throughout the land, said, I'll let them Israelites go some other time.
God promised to lead his children out of bondage. He said he'd free them from Pharaoh's evil hand. He said he'd guide them and take them on the journey and lead them to the promised land.
When they came to the bank of the ocean blue, they turned to Moses and said, what are we doing? Old Moses fell to his knees there in the sand. The Lord said, Moses, trust in God. All you gotta do is just raise that rod, and over these mighty waters, stretch your foot with your hand. Moses followed the Lord's command. The waters parted in there, and ascended. They saw a path that led to the other shore. When the ground was dry, they passed on through. Pharaoh's army thought they would too, but the waters fell. They ain't never been seen no more.
God promised to lead his children out of bondage. He said he'd free them from Pharaoh's evil hand. He said he'd guide and protect them on their journey. Lead him to the promised land.
You're listening to Daniel Britt and Friends. Diana Wetherington Helton is our guest line, the daughter of Jim Wetherington, known as Big Chief, Statesman Quartet Bass. Let's talk about the National Quartet Convention in 1973. So he's with the Statesman. Of course, the National Quartet Convention at this point had been going on for, what, about 20 years or so? So, mm-hmm. I mean, it was going strong.
Right.
Was this in Nashville or Memphis?
Probably in Nashville that year, but I know they used to bounce it back and forth.
Yeah. 1973 at the National Quartet Convention. Is that where he went and where he passed away?
That is correct. That is correct. They had been there actually a couple of days, and they had sung... Now, keep in mind, I was not there. This is all secondhand.
Right.
That was one of the years I had missed. But they had sung, and he had that morning or done something in early afternoon. Anyway, he and Mother had gone back to the hotel room, and because they had been up late the night before, they had both decided they would take a short nap before getting ready to go back that evening. They had both lay down for a nap, and she heard him get up, and then she heard him fall. She thought maybe he tripped and fallen and hit his head, which it turns out he did. He had hit his head on a table or something when he fell. Now you want the story as to what happened as far as why he fell. He actually had been hunting a year earlier and had sustained some massive bruising. They had been using a Jeep in the brush.
Mm-hmm.
They were dove and quail hunting, and the Jeep had bad brakes on it, and they had already warned the guys to stay out of the way of this Jeep because they were not sure how well the brakes were going to hold on this thing. And anyway, they had yelled for them to get out of the way, and Dad thought he had gotten out of the way, and he stepped right in the path of it, and the thing ran up his left side. He was bruised from his left heel all the way up to his left shoulder.
Wow.
And it caused just massive, massive bruising. And within just a few weeks, they had left for their West Coast tour, which they did once a year. They would take anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks, and they were gone, and they would do everything on the West Coast.
Right.
And he ended up in Eugene, Oregon. Hovey put him in the emergency room. He couldn't breathe. And that's when they found he had nephritis, which is where the blood clots get in between the space between the heart and lungs, and because
right.
of the blood clots. And anyway, they put him on blood thinner, and then they sent him home, and he recuperated from that. Well, just before going to the convention the following year, they had taken him off of the blood thinner so they could do some dental work when he got home. Now, anybody that knew Dad knew that he had lost his two front teeth when he was pole vaulting in high school. And he had caps on his two front teeth. And so every now and then they had to go in and replace those if they got loose or whatever. And that was what they were fixing to do. So they had to take him off the blood thinner for that because it was a minor surgery.
Sure.
Ended up taking him off the blood thinner too fast. It should have been monitored a lot closer. Anyway, the blood clot got loose, and because the blood clot ended up between the heart valves, the blood could not get through. So that's what eventually killed him. So, I mean, you could call it a heart attack. You could call it embolism.
Yeah.
I mean,
wow.
It was kind of both.
Right.
Yeah, he passed away, and then I actually heard about it on the news.
Really?
Yeah, because when it happened, Mother was with him, and I guess UPI figured that the closest kin knew about it, so they went ahead and released it, and Mother was still at the hospital trying to make arrangements when it was released on the 6 o'clock news. And my husband and I had just gotten married, which was the reason I was not at the quartet convention, and we'd been married about 40 days, and we were house sitting for Mom and Dad, and we'd been watching the news, and that's when we heard. And then I got a call about 30 minutes later from Hovey. So believe me, that's not the way you want to find out.
Oh, yeah.
When something happens, that's a shock. Because in those days, we didn't have cell phones.
Right.
I had no way of getting hold of anybody.
Right.
To find out, you know, is this true? So, yeah, that was quite a shocker.
And was that national news or was it local news?
Actually, that was national news.
Wow.
That it made UPI very rapidly. It hit the Nashville news first, and the UPI picked it up in Nashville.
Yeah.
And then I heard it here in Atlanta.
So how was Hovey on that call?
Very shaken.
Yeah.
Very shaken. He had a very hard time even talking. He still was pretty much in shock. I mean, actually, Doy was the first one to him. Mom knew that Doy and his wife were in the room, either next door or across the hall. And she just immediately, when he fell, and she needed help, and so she immediately went to their door and knocked on the door.
Yeah.
And so Doy came in first, and I believe his wife ended up calling the ambulance. Remembering back, she didn't know who was more shaken, herself or Doy.
Yeah. Wow.
There's an interesting aside story there. The ambulance that came to the hotel after they got Dad to the hospital and Mom was sitting waiting and they had already told her that they had lost him. The ambulance, not the driver, but the EMT that was in the ambulance, mm-hmm. came to her and she said, honestly, she said he could hardly speak. He was so broken up. And she thought this was very unusual, you know, for the EMT and the ambulance driver to be so broken up. Well, it turns out that this young man had known Dad personally. I don't even know his name. And she said this was firsthand because he talked to her. But she said he told her that he had first met Dad at a concert there in Nashville. And that he had talked to Dad, and Dad had asked him, he said, but do you understand what we're singing about? Do you understand why we sing? Hmm. And he said, no, I'm not, you know, what do you mean? He said, we're singing about the love God had for us to send his only son.
Hmm.
And this young man said, right there, said he led me to Christ.
Wow.
And he said, I would not be the person I am today, and I would not know Jesus. Had it not been for Chief.
Wow. My goodness.
He was rather heartbroken, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and I think in our conversation with Bill Gaither, he was actually in the lobby of that same hotel when he saw the stretcher come out with your dad.
Mosey Lister and I were meeting for breakfast at the Ramada Inn that year at the Cornet Convention. And we heard that Chief had a heart attack, and he was staying there. I just met Mosey because that's where he was staying. And yes, I was there, and I saw them, the paramedics come in and take the body out with the sheet over him. And I found out later that he was even dead then. Mm. And here again, Denver died when he was 43, 44. I don't think Chief was much older than 55, 56 when he passed away. That's dying pretty young. And yeah. I don't think Doy even made it to 60 years old. So, I mean, these are some icons who, according to today's standards, went out pretty early. Yeah. Both Jake and Hovey lasted into the 70s. I think they were both around 75, 76 when they passed away.
Boy, and what a shock. I mean, it's tough to lose a loved one like that anytime. But when it's sudden, and then when it's at an event that's so, I mean, music defined his life in such a big way, and that was what he loved, being at that particular event. It's very interesting how it all played out there in 73.
Right. And, you know, and you asked me a question a while ago. It was in Nashville. And the reason I remember that now is because later on, in fact, many years later, we had brought out the books, you know, the sign-in books from the funeral home in Nashville because they, you know, they had him there in the funeral home there before they brought him to Atlanta.
Right.
And I was looking through the books, you know, with some of the signatures, and I'm reading these names going, oh, my goodness, I didn't know these people were here.
Hmm.
And between the people who signed it were like people, everybody in gospel music. I mean, the names from the country music.
Wow.
Mainline musicians who recorded in Nashville had come. You just can't imagine the people who signed this book. Wow. It was I was just kind of raising my eyebrows going, oh, my goodness, you know, because I was still here in Atlanta.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know the funeral was here in Atlanta at the church where my dad was choir director here at the Assembly of God Tabernacle.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a huge funeral. I mean, you can imagine.
Right.
But the line of cars going from the church to the cemetery was over 7 miles long.
Wow. Wow.
And they wouldn't let us on the expressway because it was just too long. We had to go the back way, and it took almost 2 hours. It was terrible.
Wow.
But it was an amazing, just an amazing event, if you will. I mean, Dad would have just been horrified and humbled, I'm sure.
Yeah, to know.
Well, in this and most of the statesmen are gone now, and the very few that are still left, it just amazes me. The years have gone by so quickly, and here it is. You know, we're almost 37 years now that my dad's been gone, and his music and his ministry is still alive through videos and records and CDs and tapes and people singing his music and talking about him on Facebook. And you know, he has his own Facebook page. I mean...
You're right. I saw that.
It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, my goodness, how a person could make that much impact on the world 37 years after they died?
Yeah, it really is a great story. I mean, you look at it by today's standards, he died young, 50, 51, and but the amount the sheer number of lives he touched, the amount that he accomplished professionally, but not only that, you look at, you being a living testimony and your mother who's still living. Mm-hmm. I mean, the impact he's had on his family and friends.
Sure.
And even, like you say, your kids, his grandkids, and future generations. He has accomplished so much in that seemingly short life.
Right.
I think he would be very, he should be very proud,
I'm proud. I'm still proud of him.
Yeah.
I mean, he was my personal hero, you know.
And that's great. That's great that you have that memory. And, sometimes you're not sure what you're going to get out of these interviews. Well, Dad was a good singer, but really he wasn't much of a family man. You know, I've heard that before. And it's true and it's out there. Mm-hmm. So it's good to hear stories like this where, man, it sounded like he was an all-around great guy who loved Jesus and loved his music, loved his family.
Right. He really did. I'm just blessed that this was my heritage. But my heritage blessed so many other people as well. And that's very, very humbling, Daniel. Mm. You have no idea how humbling that is.
Well, listen, we're honored you took time to talk to us and, through the difficult times, too, of talking about his death, reliving those memories. Thanks for taking the time. Diana Wetherington-Helton.
Thank you very much. I have really enjoyed this, and I've really enjoyed talking to you and getting to know you and the wonderful work that you do on satellite radio. And wow, what an honor.
Well, we're keeping the music alive, doing the best we can and keeping these memories. So thanks for your input today and helping this great piece of the puzzle complete.
All right, well, anytime. Glad to help out. And, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about Dad. And he's still alive in a lot of hearts and minds. And he's alive in mine, and his Lord Jesus Christ is alive today, and that's what he wants people to know.
Thanks so much, Diana.
Okay, this has been enjoyable. Thanks so much, Daniel. God bless you.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Daniel Britt and Friends. Each week, Daniel brings you exciting music, conversation, and news updates from the world of Southern gospel. You can hear many of the interviews, again, online at danielbritt.com. Make a date next week for Daniel Britt and Friends.